Hello, I am Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. North Africa is making a lot of headlines these days with major uprisings in places like Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. There's no wonder that stories from this vast region are making front page news. Today on Prof Talk, Assistant Professor Jeffrey James Byrne joins me from the UBC Department of History, where he teaches on modern Middle Eastern, African, and international history. Dr. Byrne received his BA at Yale and most recently received his PhD from the London School of Economics and Political Science. His current book project, The Pilot Nation, Revolutionary Algeria in the Third World's Vanguard, 1958 to 1973, examines the radicalization and internationalization of anti-colonial nationalism. He has also written on the Cold War in Africa, socialist development models, and decolonization. He wants to get a cat, but travels far too much to take care of one. He joins me now, live in the CITR studio. Welcome, Jeffrey, to Prof Talk.
Thanks, Farah. Nice to be here.
You are receiving a lot of phone calls from journalists lately in respect to what is going on in North Africa and in the Middle East. What are reporters asking you?
Well, they basically want a summarization of one of the most substantial, important, and widespread changes in the social and political history of the Middle East for decades. And they want that summarized in about 20 words or less. So I hope I have a little bit more time today.
So what are you telling them in those 20 words or less?
I think we're witnessing a sort of the beginnings of a new era. People often, I suppose, resort to hyperbole to describe these situations, but I think in this case it's actually warranted. I think we're looking at a very substantial, certainly the most important development in the region since the Iranian Revolution in the late 1970s.
So given your background, this must be an exciting time for you.
Yes, exciting and busy. Almost too much to keep track of.
Now, you're relatively new to UBC in the history department here, and you're originally from Ireland, and you most recently studied in London, England. What have some of your experiences been thus far working as a professor here in Vancouver?
Creating a lot of course syllabuses to start with, and then having to recreate them or change them on the fly, especially this term, as all these developments are happening in North Africa. I suppose it's fun to teach very recent history. And in my courses, I like to go up to the present day or close to it. But then one of the challenges of that is that often, particularly in the Middle East, has a habit of events changing while you're already teaching a course. And you have to sort of reorganize things a bit at the last minute to try and take account of new developments.
Right. And how are things here in the history department? What have you enjoyed about being here at UBC?
Well, it seems like a very friendly, laid-back kind of place, the history department itself and UBC in general. I suppose Vancouver in general seems like it has that West Coast sort of relaxed and easygoing atmosphere, which I like. I like that a great deal. It makes for less blood pressure, which you get in other parts of the world. But the weather is perhaps not ideal, but coming from Ireland, I'm used to that. I welcome global warming, basically.
Right. I'd like to now delve into your current research because it's so relevant to what's going on right now. Tell us about your current book project on Algeria in the 1960s and 70s.
The project is, I suppose there's two aspects to it. The first aspect is about Algeria specifically, which is a country that fought a very large-scale war of independence against France in the 1950s and early 1960s. And so the first aspect of the book looks at that war of independence, that nationalist struggle, and then the policies of the Algerian nationalists after independence as they tried to create a new state, where there had previously been no state, no Algerian state, and also to devise their own economic policies and foreign policies and essentially create a country almost from scratch. And I think that's a particularly interesting country to look at, not least because the trajectory that Algeria took in the ensuing decades. It was a very, in the 1960s, had a very prominent sort of socialist left-wing oriented revolution, which was very common in the developing world at that time. And that slowly started to unravel. And then in the 1990s, the country became a lot more known to a Western audience for a very unpleasant and very destructive and costly in human terms, civil war between an Islamic-oriented insurgency and the state. So I think Algeria's own trajectory, historical trajectory in that sense, is very interesting. But that's only the first aspect. The other thing that I'm interested in about Algeria is not just because it's interesting in its own right, but because it was a very, I think it tells us a lot about the history of the developing world more broadly in that period during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. At the where decolonization, the withdrawal of Europe's empires from Africa and Asia, intersected with the Cold War, globalization, and all the sort of major trends in international history, post-war international history, they all intersected to create a very interesting situation that I think the Algerians are at the center of. And they interacted with a lot of different countries. They supported a lot of different nationalist movements in other parts of the world to try and help them along the way, and also to guide them in not only how they should pursue their own national liberation struggles, but how they should structure their countries after independence. So Algeria, I think, becomes a very interesting and fruitful window onto the third worldist phenomenon more broadly. And when I say third worldist, I'm referring to a sort of an ill-defined coalition or alliance of a great many developing countries and liberation movements in the 60s and 70s that generally had a sort of left-wing, socialist-oriented bent, were very suspicious of Western economic influence in the developing world and Western political influence in the developing world. So it was a somewhat, in the West, I guess it would be called a radical, they were called radical nationalists. From their point of view, they were just proper nationalists. But yeah, it's interesting. As I was saying at the beginning of the course, I'm teaching this term. The term itself, third world, at least in English, and I don't think this is necessarily true in other languages, but in English has acquired a sort of a negative connotation. So you almost have to have a disclaimer if you use it in the title for a book or a course or something. And I think that's because people think that third world has a sort of means third rate or implies something along those lines as being somehow inherently inferior, which is a good demonstration itself of how the much of the history of this period, even though it's extremely recent, how much of the history of this period has been lost, because a third world was a term that people like the Algerians, the Indians, the Indonesians, all sorts of people used themselves. It was an empowering term, and they didn't mean third as in sort of third ranked, as in the bronze medal, but third as in different, and perhaps they would have almost looked at it as version 3.0 of human societies, because they thought that they were, or at least hoped to create what they thought were going to be more morally legitimate societies in the ruins of European colonialism, more morally legitimate not only than the colonial regimes that they're replacing, but the Western and communist socio-economic orders themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what are some of the key events in the period of Algeria that you are researching?
Well, the War of Independence itself certainly is a big part of this story. It's been told to a certain degree. If you look at, well, I suppose it's Algeria is probably not unique in these circumstances, but if you look at, if you go to the bookshelf and in the library and you look at the shelf that's Algerian history, there'll be all sorts of books about Algeria's War of Independence. Then not very many books about independent Algeria, except for you get a little surge mm-hmm. towards the end when the Islamic insurgency is happening. So the whole sort of if it bleeds, it leads mantra for journalism definitely applies to the history of Algeria. But that said, I don't think there's any one single very satisfactory history of the Algerian War of Independence, not least because it's with very few exceptions, it's always been told, not from the Algerian perspective, but from the French perspective, almost a ridiculous degree out there. There is PhD students in history, I think, always think that everything has been written and how are they going to find a topic? And when you start looking at things like the Algerian example, you realize that that's far from the truth, because a lot of these things, and Algeria is far from unique in this case, an awful lot of histories of developing countries are written more or less from the perspective of the country that used to colonize them. That's usually France or Britain, relying on their archives or interviews with French and British people. And you'll read a lot of histories of the Algerian War of Independence that it's almost as if the Algerians don't exist. They're consigned to a secondary role in their own war of independence. And these histories are sort of not just methodologically, but I think morally very questionable on account of that. So I attempt to redress that balance to a certain degree, partly through archival research in Algeria itself. One of the fun things about looking at a country like Algeria is that essentially it was taken over by mostly young men in their 20s or early 30s in the early 1960s. And so a lot of these people are still alive. So you're able to go meet these people and interview them. And it really brings these things to life, I think, in an interesting way. So I look at the War of Independence from Algeria's perspective and show basically how they won, which is different from the story of how France lost, which is a very sort of French-oriented perspective, and puts a lot of emphasis on counterinsurgency and torture and those kind of things.
Why do you start at 1958 versus 1954, when sort of historically a lot of people talk about that date as the beginning of the independence movement?
Because the particular narrative that I am trying to draw out, I'm not trying to tell the history of everything about Algeria in the 50s and 60s. The particular narrative I'm trying to draw out is how the Algerian nationalist movement came to have this not quite unique, but certainly very exceptionally internationalist perspective. The Algerian nationalists really saw themselves as being part of this global struggle against imperialism, against neo-imperialism, as they called it. And they thought that their country, Algeria, is just one element in this broader struggle against French and British colonialism in the first instance, and then Western and, I suppose, particularly American neo-imperialism in the second instance. And this was a lot more than just sort of bluster and rhetoric and high-minded ideals. It was really manifested in the way that the Algerians conducted themselves, not just because during the War of Independence they got a lot of assistance from other developing countries and formerly colonized countries, but also because after independence they themselves turned around. And there's perhaps no country, certainly no country, that would exceed Algeria in the amount of assistance it gave to other revolutionary movements and national liberation movements after independence in 1962. And so the narrative I'm trying to tell is about explaining why they acquired this very, it's almost paradoxical that a nationalist movement should have this very internationalist perspective, and where that led them. And so I begin in 1958, although I do give some background, but I begin in 1958 because I think that's a turning point when the sort of center of gravity of the Algerian nationalist movement, the National Liberation Front, or FLN, as it was called, how their center of gravity changed, and a sort of new, younger generation, as I was saying, took over and rose to the fore, consisting particularly of students, sort of people who were studying to be lawyers, studying to be doctors. So young men and women with a university education. So they had a far more education than most of their Algerian peers. And they started to supplant the older generation in the nationalist movement and to basically take the reins. And then they're the people who took over in 1962. And so then I follow their trajectory and their internationalist goals up until its apex, really, in the 1970s.
Now, there's still not that many academic sources in English on Algeria compared to the vast literature in French. So in many ways, you're filling a very important gap in academia by doing this research.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, it's true that certainly most of the things written about Algeria are written in French, even by Algerians themselves, because French remains a very important language in Algeria. I hope I'm doing more than just something that could be achieved by translating existing French works into English. Partly because, not that there's not a lot of great scholarship done in France on Algeria. There's an awful lot written about Algeria in France. In fact, it plays a role in the French consciousness, similar to Vietnam does, say, in the American consciousness, where there's all sorts of, it's sort of a popular history topic. A new book might get prominent placing in the bookshop. They're not necessarily all academic titles. But they have a very, for the most part, a very sort of French-centric perspective. And I feel that Algeria's history has long been treated basically as a sort of ghetto or annex of French history. And I just don't think that's morally or methodologically acceptable anymore. And I'd like to try and be some small corrective to that.
Right. And also just to have, I think, the Western, you know, English-speaking world to have more access to history of a lot of these places in Africa.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because, as I said, I think it's one of the more interesting and more important in geopolitical terms countries of Africa. It's now actually the largest country in Africa because Sudan has just split in half. So if territorial size counts for anything, and I think it should, then it's literally the most important country in Africa.
Now, what brought you to studying Algeria in the first place?
It was a bit accidental, to be honest. I was always very interested in sort of early modern Russian history and the history of the Russian Empire. And I thought this sort of evolved into a history when I started graduate school into an interest in the Soviet Union, which kind of turned into an interest in the Soviet Union's relations with developing countries, because there's all sorts of interesting stories about how the Soviet Union tried to help lots of developing countries during the Cold War to develop socialist economies and to, at least in theory, modernize very quickly within the space of a few decades. And of course, most of these projects failed rather miserably. And then this gradually turned into, I sort of came across Algeria almost by accident, reading about Cuban involvement in Africa, because Cuba under Castro and Che Guevara in the 60s became heavily involved in African politics, and the Algerians became more or less their closest allies in Africa. And the Algerians very much saw themselves as a sort of revolutionary force in the world, like Cuba was. And essentially, I ended up writing about Algeria because I knew nothing about it, and I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll write this research paper and I'll learn a little something. And the next thing I knew, I was writing a PhD on it. So be careful what you write research papers on.
And so you've gone to Algeria, and who have you met there? You mentioned that you've met some important people.
Yeah, well, because a lot of the influential figures in the Algerian nationalist movement during the War of Independence and then in Algerian politics after independence, a lot of them are still alive and kicking about. Some of them have terribly interesting biographies. A man called Lakhdar Brahimi, for example, who is now retired, but he was a very prominent diplomat in sort of the United Nations and international politics for a long time. For much of the 90s, he was a very close sort of trusted advisor to Boutros Ghali and then Kofi Annan, and he did a lot of sort of diplomatic work for the UN. But he started out in the War of Independence, for example, as he basically left university. He was studying to be a lawyer. And so he left, and he must have been only 21 or 22. And because he spoke a little bit of English, but not very much, the Algerian nationalist movement, this is during the War of Independence, so the war's in full swing, and they sent him out to India because he had a smattering of English to be their ambassador in India. So it's this, and his biography, there's a lot of other people like that, but these really fascinating biographies of people who basically, instead of doing what I did, which is go to graduate school and read about people like this, they just left school and became people like that and were sort of representing their countries at a very young age, trying to learn English at the same time, dodging French security services, which are trying to arrest or assassinate a lot of these guys. So they really learned diplomacy in the saddle. And then he went on to a glittering career, not just in Algerian diplomacy, but became, as I was saying, a prominent figure in the United Nations and those sorts of international organizations. And there's quite a few other Algerians like that. That's the kind of person I've tried to interview a lot. Mm-hmm. In terms of more famous headline figures, Yassif Saadi is one who, for people who have seen The Battle of Algiers, a very well-known movie, he is the author of the book and I suppose, sort of the author of the script of the movie, author of the book that it's based on, and he plays himself in the film. He plays the character of Jafar, so he changes the name, but he's basically playing himself in the film, and he was the leader of the Algerian terrorist organization in Algiers, in the capital, during the war, and wrote these memoirs. And has been so therefore quite famous since, as he's sort of a major figure in the history of urban terrorism. So I got to meet him. He's now doesn't come across at all as this intimidating godfather of urban terrorism figure. He's this bouncy, cheerful old man who likes to do his gardening while he talks to you. Ahmed Ben Bella, who was the first prime minister and then president of Algeria after independence. I got to meet him, which is very interesting because he was deposed in a coup in 65 and then spent, after being imprisoned first by the French, he then was imprisoned by his own country for the best part of 2 decades and has kept a very low profile since. And I think he does sort of get about and shows up at certain sort of international conferences and things, but I think I'm the first person who got to, sort of first scholar who got to interview him, which was nice. So he was very interesting to talk to. And he's 91 or 92 now, but still very much with it, actually. He always had a reputation for being a very sort of energetic and charismatic person, and you could see that given he's still like that, and if you sort of reverse time by 50 years, so when he was much younger, you can see how he must have been a very dynamic and charismatic political figure at the time. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so there's definitely an older generation that come from, you know, the time of the War of Independence, but now we have a very young generation in Algeria that mm-hmm. are rebelling against, you know, the political government of Algeria. They're essentially their own government. So things have really changed in that way. And how do you comment on that and how history has changed in such a short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, one of the tragic things about Algeria and a lot of other countries in the region is after this basically quite heroic story in the 50s and 60s. When I say heroic, that's not to sort of ignore all of the darker aspects of that story, but certainly this on a certain level heroic story of national liberation, the great ambitions that Algeria's new young leaders had for their country, the glorious shining future that they thought their country had. To see that it's become sort of a poster child country now for post-colonial disillusionment, and sort of every young person you talk to essentially just wants a American or French visa, very disillusioned with their country, with the sort of closed state of the political system, the closed state of the cultural order as well, because one of the consequences of the Islamic insurgency in the 90s is essentially that you could argue that the Islamists lost the actual war, but they won the cultural war. And so the Algerian society has become much more conservative and sort of emphatically, quote-unquote, Islamic since the 1990s. And you meet, for example, young women in their late teens or early 20s who will show you photographs of their mothers at their age in the 60s and 70s strolling around Algiers, shopping, and it's a country's got very nice weather, so enjoying the weather, and just strolling around in a skirt or trousers or whatever they happen to be wearing, their daughters or granddaughters today feel obliged to wear the hijab or even more conservative clothing, otherwise they'll get very harassed in the street. So there's a lot of, particularly if you talk to Algerian women, a sense of a sort of cultural and social regression. The sense of the things that they were promised, women were promised in the 1960s, that promise having been betrayed very emphatically.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I think we could continue this conversation. Definitely very interesting. It's been a great pleasure.
You're welcome. All right. Likewise.
You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Jeffrey James Byrne from the Department of History. If you'd like to learn more about his research, you can visit the history website at www.history.ubc.ca. Next week, I will speak with his colleague, Dr. Danny Vickers, who is also from the Department of History. We will discuss the subject of history as a field of study and relate it to some of the key aspects in his department, as well as his own research on early America. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, you can visit citr.ca. And please do check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also email us now at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I'd like to end today's show with some music from Algeria. The band is called Harmonica, and the song is titled Bledi. And here it is. I'm Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.
Oh, yeah, boy. Explore the arts this winter at League Square Community Arts Village. They're offering an exciting lineup of visual and performing arts programs this winter, including capoeira, Brazilian dance, and martial arts for 3 to 12-year-olds. Parent and taught jam sessions, the iGirl Empowerment and Art Workshop for ages 9 to 12, and adult classes in digital photo editing and photography, just to name a few. Registration is available online at experienceit.ca or call 604-927-7529 for a full listing of arts and culture programs in Port Coquitlam. For more information on Lee Square, please visit portcoquitlam.ca/arts or call 604-927-8400.
This is a top to a, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
CITR 101.9 FM.
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.